Thank you. Sarvaitam Savadutam Prajna Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shiva Sakanzvitam Scha Hey Krishna Karna Sindho Dinabandha Vidatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Taptakanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavaneshri Prishubhanu Siddhudevi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakalpa Drubhyascha Kripa Sinubhyascha Adhidana Bhagavevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Maha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Jayadvaita Narasivasiddhi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya So thank you for coming. Actually, I'm substituting for Satchinanda Maharaj, who I saw in Serbia, who was quite sick actually, but he's better now. He's just getting over some serious illnesses. And I was asked to give a summary of the second canto. So that's not very easy. Do a summary of a whole canto. I was trying to find out how to do it, and I listened to Bhajan Guru's takes on the second canto, which he gave in Perth around 1998, and I listened to the Bhakti by Baba course given by Mother Narayani and Bhajan, and I discovered that they didn't really give a summary of the second canto, but they gave little Bhagavatam classes every day. So that's all right, except that they did it around 25 days, and we only have 5 days. And I don't know if you want to hear a Bhagavatam class for 5 days, because Purusha Maharaj heard it for 7 days and nights. But I thought maybe I'd inquire from you how you'd like me to conduct the class, so that doesn't becomes as interesting and as informative as possible. But one thing is that this afternoon we're supposed to have a Bhajan class, and before we go over anything else, maybe we should ask for everyone's names. I'm not very good at names, by the way. I'm much better at slogans than I am at names. So we can go around the room, starting with you.
My name is Esmico.
Very good.
Thank you. Good question.
Erica.
Erica.
Kai.
Sarah.
What was that name?
Kai.
Kai. What nationality is that?
Estonia.
Okay. Yes.
Sarah.
Natasha.
Natasha.
I assume you know my name, so. Kopishwar.
Kopishwar.
Yes. Who's your spiritual master?
Radha
Maharaj. I was trying to figure out on a tape, but it's just listening to the tape by Radha Kurman, who you were trying to figure out your name. I couldn't hear the name of your spiritual master. I couldn't figure it out what it was. So, how would you like me to do it? We could. I just read the second canto. Although before I was asked to do the class, I'm on the fourth canto now. So that means probably I read 10 verses a day from the Bhagavatam usually. So that means probably a year ago I had read the second canto, or half a year ago. And I just read it again for the last month. But then I realized after listening to all the tapes that even though I had read it, I got some idea of an overview, but I could probably explain that in around 20 minutes. But the overview for the second canto is. Which would be alright, except for the fact that I wonder what we do for the rest of the 4 days. So, how would you like to do it? We could read some verses. There's not so many second cantos, and we can go over some of the important verses. But first, I guess I should ask, how many of you have read the second canto? So, okay. How many have not read the second canto? So around half. How many have read it recently? How many can tell me all the different names of the... How many chapters are there in the 10th canto? Does anyone know?
10th canto.
What's that?
10th canto. How many chapters in
the 2nd canto? Oh, second canto. What's that? Okay. Close. It's 10. Yeah, 10. So most don't know. And how many know the names of the second canto, the chapters of the second canto? How many know the name of the first chapter of the second canto? So, okay, at least one. Alright, so mostly we're a little familiar with it. Some half are a little familiar with the second canto, and some don't really know so much at all about what the second canto is about. Luckily, the second canto is about the same thing all the other cantos are about. Yes, you guessed it.
Just look through it before coming upstairs.
Yeah. Well, you'll find that everything, all our books are about Krishna. Which is not unusual. Now, what is unusual that we will find interesting, hopefully, is that it's presented in a way to help us understand something more about Krishna. Prabhupada has repeatedly explained, especially he explains in the second canto, emphasizes a part of Krishna which sometimes is not very common, even within our present-day ISKCON. In other words, that the Bhagavatam is presented systematically according to the general audience, the idea what the general audience would be. General audience meaning that someone who doesn't understand very much about Krishna, or doesn't know anything about Krishna, or understands just as much as one will be able to understand by somewhat of a knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita. As most of you probably know, that the Bhagavad Gita is considered the preliminary knowledge of devotional service, and the Bhagavatam is considered to be the postgraduate study of the Bhagavad Gita. And then the Chaitanya Charitamrita is considered to be even a more advanced study of Krishna consciousness. Now the first and second cantos will be described as the feet of the Lord. And as we heard in
Krishna Kshetra Puru's class today, that generally our deity worship is done from the feet and then gradually working up to the smiling face of the Lord. So the second candle is part of the feet of the Lord, or at least probably the ankles of the Lord. And so it gives us knowledge which we could probably, if we think about it, relate to. In other words, if we gave a class on the Krishna book, then very nice stories about Krishna walking on the banks of the Yamuna, playing on his flute, and the peacocks, the birds, they're in ecstasy, stunned, closing their eyes, their description of Krishna. It's very poetic and very relishable. So why do we bother with all these other philosophical candles? Because if when we go through the second canto, we'll find that it's very philosophical. Matter of fact, there is the only pastime that's being described as the pastime of creation, which most of us, our hairs won't stand on end unless we're Arjuna hearing about the pastime of creation. But this is explained that hearing the pastimes of creation or hearing the basic philosophy is necessary if we factually want to understand Krishna in truth. Because Krishna in truth is not simply Krishna in Vrindavan, playing on his flute surrounded by the gopis. Krishna in truth means Krishna is everywhere and there is nothing but Krishna. So one is factually realizing Krishna consciousness that wherever they look, whatever they do, will remind them of Krishna in Vrindavan, playing on his flute. That state is not so easy to come to because the material world, by its nature, by the nature of the illusory energy, separates us from Krishna in Vrindavan, or even Krishna in Vaikuntha. Instead, what we see is our own conceptions of life in each one of us, because whatever our condition is, we're going to have a different conception of life. That's why in the material world, there is conflict, there is disunity, there is things that people consider undesirable, and although they attempt to nullify them or rectify them or modify them, they can't do it. Because as long as we have a different conception of life, then we'll have a different understanding of what we're going to do for happiness. And in the material world, the conception of life, the unifying conception of life, as will be explained in the second canto, is that I am matter and that things belonging to this body, they belong to me. And although we may say that we belong to a certain country, a certain nationality, a certain religion, a certain race, a certain gender, but we only share in common those things with those persons as we try to exploit material nature in a cooperative way. So Krishna consciousness starts from quite a high platform of understanding that all these conceptions that we have are wrong. All the material conceptions we have are wrong, and that we have to start from a different conception which we haven't realized fully, at least. We have to realize it partially, but we haven't realized it in as much as that some of our previous conceptions, whether we're aware of them or not, were still influenced by them, at least, if not directed by them. Namely, I am this body, and those things which are pertaining to the body are actually related to me. And intellectually, it will not be possible for any of us to simply free ourselves by some intellectual effort at that particular or our conditioned nature. But we should understand it so that we can make an attempt at trying to do what's necessary to free ourselves from. So one of the things that will be explained here is just by submissive hearing from the right source, that will at least help us come to a higher platform of understanding. At least at very minimum, it's a preliminary method so that we can accept the fact that we're Krishna's servants, and therefore in our practical dealings, our everyday dealings, including just sitting here and talking about Krishna, we can make some progress, developing the proper mood, the proper vision, because from our activities comes a certain experience, and from that experience comes a certain conception of life, from that conception of life also comes a certain mood. So we're trying to change ultimately our mood from material, that is, I am actually this body, I am actually the independent doer of my activities, that I'm actually supposed to be happy for what I'm doing, etc. To the mood that I am simply Krishna's servant, and that the best I can be, which is quite good, is to be an instrument to Krishna, and try to please Krishna by my activities. But the second canto especially will take us from the beginning. How many of you have read the first canto? Okay. So the first canto, just give an overview of the first canto. The Srila Vyasadeva, as we find out in the beginning, was in anxiety that he had finished compiling the Vedic literature, and the Vedic literature deals with principally how to elevate oneself in the material world, both mentally, physically, and intellectually, so that one can live here comfortably in this lifetime, get a more comfortable position in the next lifetime, understand how to get free from material conceptions and attachments, and ultimately get out of the material world and hopefully go into some other world, either Brahman or Vaikuntha, something. But he wasn't very happy because, although the Vedic literature is very vast, somehow or another he felt some despondency within his heart. And Narada Muni came at that time and told him that, although you glorify the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you haven't written anything which specifically aims and explains exactly how Krishna is the ultimate purpose of everything, how everything, he is everything. And then Srila Vyasadeva begins his Srimad Bhagavatam with Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. The same thing as in this canto. We already chanted the first verse. And the invocation leads. And then he says, Janma Vyasya Tovaya Itara Tash Chartesh Baba Vyasvara, that Krishna is the source of everything, the creator, maintainer, the annihilator. So this is interesting because he begins from the same verse, which is one of the Chatur Sloki verses in the Bhagavad Gita. Namely, Aham Sarvasya Prabhava Matav Sarvam Pravartite Iti Mata Bhajante Imam Buddha Bhava Samanditaha. That there's nothing but Krishna, everything is coming from Krishna. One who understands everything in relation to Krishna, he develops love for Krishna. And that's the way that one gets, if one has love for Krishna, then automatically knowledge and detachment to the material world follow, and therefore, as Bhagavad Gita said, one becomes eligible to return back to Godhead. In other words, that the whole aim of the Bhagavad Gita is to show us how everyone and everything is related to Krishna, so that we can develop love for Krishna, love for everyone and everything, and therefore become eligible to go back to the spiritual world. Develop, come to the state of Bhava. That will also be explained in the ninth chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the second canto, the ninth chapter, and the Chatur Sloki verses. Beginning with Aham Eva Sagare, Aham Eva Sagare. That, which will explain how everything comes from Krishna. So this is the beginning of the Bhagavatam, Srimad Bhagavatam, first chapter, that everything comes from Krishna. And anything that we think doesn't come from Krishna is just like different phases of illusion that even the demigods are subjected to. So if we find ourselves somewhere in illusion, we shouldn't worry too much because even the demigods are also in illusion. Of course, we should try to get out of illusion. But it's common in the material world. Then, Srila Vyasadeva, later on we find out in the seventh chapter, the second canto, first canto, that he meditated, Bhakti Yoga Namanasa Samyak Pranite Male, Parampurusham, that he meditated in trance and he saw Krishna, Bhakti Yogena Manasi, Samyak Panihi Te Male. Without any covering, and his mind became purified, Purusham, Parampurusha, I forget the next word. Anyhow, he saw Krishna and long Maya Tat Apashraya. And he saw Maya, Krishna along with Maya in his backside of Krishna. So the idea is that in the seventh chapter of that particular, of the first canto, he understood that everything is Krishna. There's nothing but Krishna and Krishna's energy. He saw the living entity bewildered by Maya, suffering the threefold miseries, and therefore he compiled the Srimad Bhagavatam. In the meantime, you find in the first canto there are the sages, they're asking questions. They're assembled for a sacrifice in the first chapter of the first canto, and somehow or another the sacrifice is not working out because it's Kali Yuga. And all they're doing is getting a lot of smoke, so they're getting a little worried because after all the sacrifice is scheduled for 1,000 years. And they didn't really feel that in 1,000 years the waves just getting black from the smoke. Therefore, they were happy that Sutta Goswami somehow or another came. And as we know, Sutta Goswami had heard the Srimad Bhagavatam because he was present when Shukadeva Goswami was speaking the Bhagavatam to Maharaj Pariksit. And therefore, they were very happy to see him. He was taking the position. Later on, we find out that Rama Harshan, he was giving a discourse, and Baladev came after touring, going on pilgrimage. And at that particular time, Rama Harshan didn't stand up to greet Lord Baladev. So Baladev, realizing that I've come here to kill the demons are those who don't appreciate Krishna or his devotees. So, realizing that Baladev was thinking that this person's insulting Krishna because he had shows me no respect, he took a little piece of kusa grass and killed him on the spot. And then the sages, they mentioned to Baladev that we had given him the benediction, that he would live a long time, and that he'd speak to Bhagavad, that he'd lead the sacrifice. But now that he's dead, you've nullified our benediction, so what to do? So Lord Baladev said, well, I'll bring him back to life, whatever you want, it's all right with me. They said, no, we want him dead because you killed him. We don't want to nullify your uncommon use of the kusa grass weapon. But at the same time, we've benedicted him with, we don't want that nullified either. And Baladev said, well, I'll bring his son, Sutta Goswami. So he can perform the sacrifice. So here we find Sutta Goswami speaking to the sages in Namasharanya about what he had heard from Shukadeva Goswami, answering the questions. And as you can expect, that the second chapter deals with the questions that the sages were asking and gives us an overview of pure devotional service. And pure devotional service, we'll find out, is manifested in the third chapter, which deals with the incarnations. Now, in the fourth and fifth chapters, how Sutta Goswami had come to hear about the Bhagavatam is explained. How Vyasadeva was lamenting, and how his spiritual master Narada Muni came and gave him instructions explaining about what his personal experience was hearing Krishna consciousness. And that how, if people hear Krishna Katha, because Narada Muni, as we know, his process of realization was that he was a maidservant son, and that his mother was serving the Bhaktivedantas during the Chaturmasya season. And at that time, Narada Muni was also serving them, bringing them prasad specifically, and having gotten the opportunity to give their remnants and doing service to them, he also started to hear the Srimad Bhagavatam, or the glories of Krishna. And he got a taste hearing about Krishna. And therefore, the Bhaktivedanta has instructed him in the process of Krishna consciousness. Although he was a small boy, later on, his mother was bitten by a snake. He left, and he followed their instructions while traveling. And at that time, Krishna revealed himself, and he became very anxious to become Krishna conscious and spend the rest of his life searching after Krishna. And at the time of his leaving his body, he became illuminated, just like lightning and illumination occurs simultaneously. And he became a great spaceman, Narada Muni. So Narada Muni was showing, I just heard about Krishna. So why don't you compile the Bhagavatam about Krishna? And if people just hear about Krishna systematically, in the same way that I heard, they can also get the same result that I got, becoming fully Krishna conscious. And so Śrīla Vyāsadeva sat in meditation, realized Krishna, and then compiled the Bhagavatam. So we now are up to the 7th chapter, now 8th chapter is Vishnavid. Queen Kunti's prayers. So Krishna, now we're introduced to Krishna because that's the person we're supposed to hear about, and Queen Kunti's praying all about Krishna. 8th chapter is Vishwadeva. Vishwadeva is instructing how Yudhisthira Maharaj and the Pandavas, specifically how to understand everything and how to run kingdom properly so that people can become Krishna conscious. That is the goal. Because after all, Duryodhana was killed or was defeated by Krishna specifically because although he knew how to run the kingdom, he wasn't a devotee. So Bhishmadeva infuses in his instructions to Yudhisthira Maharaj about how to be a devotee, at the same time be a proper manager. And then the rest of the chapter deals with Bhishmadeva's departure, so how he relates that all the glorious devotees and how they fix their mind upon Krishna, because at this time he was leaving his body and he wanted to fix his mind upon Krishna. So the goal is indicated to fix the mind upon Krishna. In the other chapters we find Krishna, this person we're trying to fix our mind upon, going to Dwarka. Then we find out about the departure of the Pandavas, Vidura for instance preaching to Dhritarashtra, his brother, get out, Kali Yuga's coming, you better do something, go out, fix your mind on Krishna. And how he fixes his mind, find Krishna in devotion, and get some elevation. Then we find out Kali Yuga's coming, it's time to retire, the Pandavas retire, try to go back to the spiritual world, and then Pariksha Maharaj was born. He was a posthumous child. That is, his father had died. Abhimanyu had died in the battle of Kurukshetra. He was born without a father. Krishna had protected him in the womb. Therefore, he had a chance to see Krishna. Ashwatthama had thrown a brahmastra. And therefore, throughout his whole life, he was looking for Krishna. Therefore he's called Pariksha, the examiner. Asking everyone, are you Krishna? Are you Krishna? Trying to figure out who is Krishna around here. You find out he becomes the king. He's qualified in so many ways. He finds out that in his kingdom, Kali Yuga is starting. One black man is beating on the cow and the bull. He protects religious principles. And then he is cursed by Sringi to die in 7 days. And he goes to the bank of the Jamuna, of the Ganges, fasting to death, and he asks that all these sages assemble, and he starts asking them what he should do now that he's about to die. And all kinds of sages assemble, the Gyanis, the Yogis, the Karmis, all different types of sages, and Yogis are assembled and they're giving him so many different points, so many different instructions. And then finally Sukadeva Goswami appears at the end of the first canto, and all the sages, with the exception of Narada Muni and Vyasadeva, stand up offer him respect, give him the seat of honor, and now it's expected that Shukadeva Goswami, just by his physiological, just by his physiognomy, they all recognize him as a great personality, high, realized soul, capable of instructing Maharaj Pariksit. Now they're going to ask him what Pariksit Maharaj will approach him. Ask him, what am I supposed to do at the time of death? And now we saw with the second canto. Of course, we can understand that things are not really divided into cantos. I don't know if Srila Vyasadeva specifically told his son, Shukadeva Goswami, that I'm going to explain to you the Bhagavatam in 12 cantos. Or that Shukadeva Goswami, when he's speaking to Pariksit Maharaj, said, now is the end of canto 1. Tomorrow, this evening, I'll tell you canto 2. But it's a continuum. So the continuum is we're starting in the second canto, and Shukadeva Goswami, first of all, he's going to, I'll give you an overview of the whole second canto now. He's going to answer, first of all, the doubts that Pariksit Maharaj might have. Because Pariksit Maharaj doesn't have so many doubts, but this Bhagavatam is presented for us, and we have many doubts. Sometimes we're not aware of our doubts. That may be most of the time, what our doubts are. But I guess we can take as a measuring stick that if we just try to question, am I my body? Am I a soul? And if I'm a soul, then who am I? So how many can say, you don't have to raise your hand, you can just think about it, how many of us can really say that I'm completely and totally off, away from the bodily concept of life? That I have no bodily identification, that my body to me is something just like a dream. And that I never, in any circumstance, ever follow the dictation of my senses or my mind. I'm totally sense and mind controlled, and that the only dictation I ever follow under any circumstance is always what Krishna wants me to do, because I'm totally and fully aware of Krishna's direction. So most of us, I think, we can admit that we're not quite on that platform. Therefore, the question is, why are we not on that platform? So that is considered to be doubts. Samshaya. Asha. Asha. I don't know if the exact Sanskrit word is ashraya from the sam means complete and samshaya. A samshaya means without doubt, and samshaya means we have some clouds over our consciousness. So in order to get free from those clouds, the clouds will be explained in the second chapter or the second canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam what some of those clouds are. We already know what the clouds are, but they'll be explained systematically so we can get a more deep understanding of what they are and how they relate to our practical devotional service. First chapter, second chapter, third chapter, they deal specifically with what some of those doubts are. First chapter deals with materialism. That is, for us, in this particular stage of our existence, conditioned life, material seems very real. That what happens in the world seems quite relevant to our lives. If we suddenly found out that Iraq had decided to invade Belgium for whatever reason, we'd be concerned about it. Because right now we're in Belgium. Or if Muslim countries got together, which may be more believable, and that they attacked Italy, and they were passing Switzerland, and they were on their way to Belgium, we'd be quite concerned. We probably would be hard to fix our minds in the Bhagavatam. We'd be reading the newspapers to find out where they're at now, and where it's safe to go to. So this world seems quite real to us. And when we talk about spiritual things, it doesn't seem as relevant to our lives. Because after all, even if you graduate from Bhaktivedanta College right now, even if you attend it, even if you get a certificate, and you present that in your job application, that I can explain perfectly how everything is related to Krishna. You probably wouldn't get a higher paid job.
You might even get the job.
So it doesn't seem as relevant to us who are in the material concept of life to exactly why we're here and what the relevance is. Of course, to some extent, we must have some faith that we are spiritual, and therefore it does have relevance to us because that's who we are. Although our conception of life, our experience presently may not be confirming it completely. In any case, the first chapter will deal with materialism, the universal form, how to see Krishna within this material cosmic creation, and how even seeing Krishna in this world won't help us very much unless we develop a service attitude. That will be stressed in the first chapter, service attitude. So that seems how a pantheist, seeing the world, also has to develop a service attitude if he wants to make any progress. That even you see the material world in relation to God, but if there's no service attitude, then there's no progress. So that's so many karmis were present when Pariksha Maharaj was here in the Bhagavatam. They had given Pariksha Maharaj fights. Shukadeva Goswami more or less clears up that particular aspect called karma. That this world is sacred, therefore we have a duty here, and that will bring us to the perfection of life. We do our duty, we see things in a higher way, the universal form. Cosmic creation is God. Next chapter, the law in the heart, of course, deals with karma, but the yogi will find out he's trying to elevate himself, going through the cosmic creation that's been described, the universal form. He goes to the topmost planet, he gets liberation. What's next? That's not the end of it. That even liberation is not the end. The karmas are dealt with, the second chapter, liberation is dealt with, Brahmana realization. But now Paramatma realization will be dealt with in the second chapter. And probably gets a very famously elaborates in a very famous verse, which will tell us that even in this present conditioned life, we can realize Paramatma and his presence by the use of our intelligence. We'll go over that particular verse especially. That we don't have to become great gyanis or mystics. We don't have to become great controllers to understand the presence of Paramatma within our heart. The same intelligence that we use to understand the difference between ourselves and the body, we can also utilize to see Paramatma. Now in the third chapter, after going through that, Pariksha Maharaj will talk about all how Paramatma here in the material world is fulfilling everyone's desires, specifically and especially through the demigods. And that one can look for so many benedictions from the demigods. But ultimately, a person who wants something higher than all that, he doesn't need any benediction, either from the demigods, what to speak of these even smaller personalities in this world, that a person looking for Krishna consciousness, he can live very simply, and if he executes pure devotional service, depending on Krishna, then he can realize Krishna. And then we go into the fourth chapter, which is called Course of All Course, the Process of Creation of Belief. Mm-hmm. Now we're starting with how this is already explained. We should become devotees of Krishna. He's explained to Maharaj Pariksit, you don't have to listen to the gyanis that are present here, or the yogis, or the mystics, or the impersonalists. You don't have to listen to any of them. Everything is within Krishna consciousness. And now systematically he'll begin to explain how this present universe is also related to Krishna and what the purpose of it is. So So this is going, we're going to go through a very systematic presentation of what this universe is, how it's related to Krishna, how everything is caused by Krishna, and then something about the incarnations of Krishna, why they're coming, as we hear from the Bhagavad Gita, what their purposes are. All of them we know are to protect the devotees, annihilate the miscreants, and reestablish religious principles. So what religious principles they're establishing, what they have to show us, is given in this 8th chapter. In the 9th chatter we have the Chaturshloki verses, a summary of the whole Bhagavatam. And in the 10th chapter we have a description of the 10 categories of Bhagavatam. And the rest of Bhagavatam will explain about these 10 categories. Specifically, I believe 8 of them are dealing with Sambandha Gyan, understanding more systematically about this universe and how it works in relation to Krishna, about the incarnations who come and how they relate to the devotees to help them, elevate them in Krishna consciousness, and what our position is. The other one deals with Abhideya, the process of devotional service. And the last one deals with the Ashraya, namely the 10th canto, in the pastimes of Krishna. Krishna is the shelter of everything. So those are the brief summary, first and second chapters, cantos. Anyone have any questions? Third canto, we'll hear about Vidura and Maitreya, and I think specifically a very relevant quote by Vidura is that Vidura said, "I already heard all about the creation before. I don't really want to hear about it again, but I want to hear it in detail how it's related to Krishna." We'll hear about creation, especially in the first canto. We heard something about creation. Second canto, we'll hear about creation in a number of ways. Third canto, we'll hear about creation, but we'll hear about it in a number of different angles. The idea basically is that if we keep on hearing these things and assimilate the knowledge, then we'll be able to understand and have, or at least have some faith in later descriptions of how Krishna is working here in the material world. Because after all, by the time we get into the 10th canto, we should already understand that there are demigods, because Krishna will have so many pastimes with Indra and Brahma, and even has pastimes with Varuna, Varessa's father. We'll have to understand that there is Krishna to begin with. It was the 10th canto, we'll talk about Krishna, and that his holding up Govardhan Hill for 7 days is not so extraordinary, because with a little fragment of himself, of his energy, he's supporting all the planets and their orbits and everything else. So in order to appreciate the 10th canto, we should have firm faith in all the other, in the other 9 cantos. We should have already experienced, realized to a large extent what the other 9 cantos were explaining. Namely that everyone, everything here is related to Krishna. There's really nothing separated from Krishna. We're never separated from Krishna. We were never separated from Krishna. We never can be separated from Krishna. Only due to our conditioning, the coverings of illusion, due to our lack of service attitude towards Krishna, therefore we think, we're imagining that we're in some other situation other than serving Krishna. That whatever the scientists are saying about the universe, whatever the politicians are explaining about their methodology of solving our problems, that is, if it's not dealing with Krishna consciousness, it's just imagination. That 99.9% of our lives and 100% of other people's lives are all just imagination. So that we have to understand from many different points of view. Then what will happen, hopefully, is that while we're doing our service, we'll think about Krishna. That I'm actually doing this to please Krishna, and I don't really have to do anything else. I don't have to worry about anything else. I don't have to do anything else. That just whatever I'm doing right now, and if I'm doing it to please Krishna, then it's perfect. That Krishna doesn't need me to sustain the universe. He's doing it through his, he already appointed other people to do it. He doesn't need me to change anyone's life. He's already the super soul in everyone's heart. He's doing a good job. He doesn't need me to save the world. But I need him and I need his process of devotional service if I'm going to get out of illusion. I have to understand what it is, accept it and practice it. And then whatever the consequences are, whatever the results are of my particular service, Krishna will enjoy them. But if I'm offering it to Krishna properly, then the benefit I'll get is I'll get out of my material concept of life. So there's no, any questions? Anything else?
You said that we are never separated from Krishna, and then you said later on that due to the illusionary energy, we are separated from him.
We think we are.
Do you see him? Yes, because I know he's there, we see him and everything, but I do not have a personal relationship with him, so I am separated from him.
Are you? In one sense we are, in the other sense we're not. Just like, whose energy you're sitting on right now?
His.
Who's controlling the energy that you're sitting on?
Him.
Who's Lord Jagannath?
Krishna.
So how can you say you're separated from him? Who's in your heart telling you what to say and do and think?
Krishna.
Well, if we're separated, it's not a very far separation. But we think we're separated. We, fortunately, we have some theoretical understanding and maybe some realization too. To a certain extent, some realization. But we don't feel his presence, therefore we, all the time. Or we don't fully experience his presence, therefore, to some extent, we think we're separated from him. But we can't do anything without him. We can't even think we're separated from him without his help. So even to be in Maya, we're depending on him. Unless the materialist is praying to Krishna, please put me in Maya, they couldn't be in Maya. So to a certain extent, whatever we're experiencing, we're all depending on him. But the material nature is made in such a way it makes us unconscious of how much we're with Krishna and how much we're dependent on him. That's called illusion. Is that right?
Yes.
Anything else? So let's start with the first chapter, first step of God's realization. We only have one book. So we'll read some of the English, and I'll go over some of the verses here. How many books do we have?
We have
one?
Two downstairs.
Okay. I'll start by reading. Oh my Lord, the all-pervading personality of Godhead, I offer my respectful obeisance unto you. With his own mode, Bhagavad Vasudevaya, which we're all quite familiar with, which has been explained as the same thing as the Hare Krishna mantra. Now, in the first text in the second canto, Prabhupada lectured on quite extensively. The certain verses in the Bhagavatam, the second canto, the Prabhupada, that were considered very significant verses, and Prabhupada gave many classes on it. Interesting enough, I don't know if he gave any classes on the Chaturshloki verses. But these first verses, he did give many classes on. So the first verse, I'll read the Sanskrit. Shishu Guvacha Varyana Eshate Prashna Krita Loti Taripaha Atnavit Samata Kumsam Shoti Yadishu Yadparaha. Shishu Gudeva Goswami said, "My dear king, your question is glorious because it is very beneficial to all kinds of people. The answer to this question is a prime subject matter for hearing and is approved by all transcendentalists." You might be curious what his question was. Does anyone know what his question was? He actually asked a number of questions.
One of the questions is about the Vajrayana here. What do you come out?
Yeah.
What is the view to the whole person, all circumstances, and what is the view to special classes of Vajrayana?
Yes, that's good. What is the way of perfection probably translates? Please let me know what a man should hear, chant, remember, and worship, and also what he should not do. Please explain all this to me. This will be the subject matter, especially of the answers. And especially the first one. What if the person is about to die? And as we all know, as we don't like to be reminded of sometimes, we're all about to die. In one sense, for a materialist, it means that whatever they're working for will be lost. And the same thing for us, that we're going to lose this body and everything related to the body. But if our aim is Krishna consciousness, then we won't lose anything, because the devotee knows he didn't have anything to begin with, but it's all Krishna's. On the other hand, death is not to be looked, usually people don't look forward to it, but one who's factually Krishna conscious, he doesn't really even receive death. Because, as we find in the Madhuri Kandambini, the description, when the devotee leaves his body, when he's at the elevated state of prema, he doesn't even know he left his body. All he knows is that his virtual Lord is directing him back to his home in the spiritual world. So for most of us, we're not on that platform. And we should be inquisitive. What is the duty of a person who's about to die? So that means all of us. It's one thing we all have in common. We may not have the common hobbies or interests. We may not have common anything, even language or likes, dislikes. But we have one thing in common. Very shortly, in approximately less than a minute of Brahma's life, much less than a minute, that we're all going to leave our bodies, and we should know what to do in the meantime. So that's what this question was. So everyone can relate to that. So Shukadeva Goswami says that, "My dear king, your question is glorious, because it's very beneficial to all kinds of people. The answer to this question is a prime subject matter for hearing and is approved by all transcendentalists." All the transcendentalists were assembled there, and they all could agree, yes, this is a very intelligent question. Let's see what Shukadeva Goswami's answer is. In modern society, people generally don't discuss this topic because they don't believe anyone has the answer. And even if someone comes along and says, "Well, I have the answer," people don't really take it very seriously. Because they don't, deep in one's heart, being trained up by materialists and impersonalists, people don't believe that there is any solution to death. Although the scientists advertise that shortly they'll find a cure for death, we'll take a pill, and we'll live for as long as we want. And there may be so many science fiction stories about Frankenstein, how Frankenstein, they shot some electricity through his body and he came alive. So people believe these things to a certain extent. They have some faith in the material science. I was reading one survey where they were asking people in America about Iraq. And the majority of people in America, they believe that Saddam Hussein had atomic weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. That's why America invaded Iraq. Mm-hmm. And that's after, well, in any case, they're wrong. But most of the people in America believe like that. So similarly, most of us, we have some conception about that there, what the goal of life is and how to achieve it. And most people don't believe that the goal of life is to figure out what to do at the time of death. Is something they think is to avoid, although they know they can avoid. And they have some faith in the scientists that in the future maybe they can solve that problem. Although old age is much easier to solve than death, they can't solve that problem because they haven't, the scientists themselves, they can't stop themselves from growing older. And easier than old growing older is to stop disease. But they haven't been able to stop anyone from being diseased, as we can all see here. We look at everyone's posture. That there's no pill that can teach us how to keep our spine straight so that we can sit in class for for more than 45 minutes. Because we all feel uncomfortable. Even if the class is alright, even if we tell a few jokes here and there, still, our spine will begin to hurt us. And if we sit on a chair, after 45 minutes we get up from the chair, it will also hurt. So even the smallest thing, stopping disease, whether you speak of tuberculosis, or heart disease, or cancer, or some other more serious disease, they can't stop even the little diseases, like a cold, or toothache. So that's, they can't stop that. What to speak of the body changing, what to speak of the final change called death. Since time immemorial, everyone has died so far, and it's, even Brahma can't stop death, and how we with our smaller brains, we can't create a universe, how are we going to stop death? Brahma created the universe, put all the planets there, he can't stop death. Hiranyakashipu, after going through an austerity for 120 years of the demigod standing on the tips of his toes, couldn't stop death. So how are we going to stop death? We can't stop death. We can't stop old age, we can't stop disease, and we're not going to be able to stop taking birth again. But these problems, at least the Bhagavatam says it has a solution to get out of illusion. And that Sri Deva Goswami will gradually try to help us out of illusion by speaking the Bhagavatam in a systematic way. So this is from, this is 2.1.116. The activities of, this is in the purport.
Verse 1?
Yeah, we're on verse 1. Do you want to make an announcement? We're going to stop right now, actually. So we're going to have a break for 10 minutes now. Give everyone a chance to stretch. And then Mother Alkananda is going to make an announcement.
Just inform the devotees who are not the students of the college. They're supposed to come to the college office, which is across the street in BLS. And they're supposed to be registered. And there is also some fee to pay. The course is €50. I'm here between 10:30 and 1:30. 9:30 and 1:30 every day. Tomorrow I won't be there, and probably Monday as well. But you can also approach me in the temple, whatever is more convenient for you. Regarding registering, because we need, it's some legal obligation for the government. Like in the guest house, everybody who's staying overnight in the guest house should enter also become officially becoming member of Rajna. So also in this case, they would just have to become officially members of the college. But that doesn't mean anything for you, really, practically. We just need your information. It would be good that you bring your passport, because you need passport number, your legal address, your legal name, with some legal information.
Okay. One thing that we had a suggestion that instead of doing a bhajan this afternoon, that we go on Harinam.
Oh,
is that a good idea?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How many would prefer to go on Harinam?
What did
I? Yeah, just today. So we'll go on Harinam today. You've been on Harinam before?
Once.
Is that alright?
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll go on Harinam. What time is Harinam leave?
3 o'clock.
3 o'clock. What time does it come back?
Usually
most of the time. Okay. What's going on here? How many devotees is organizing Harinam?
Rick is organizing.
Who?
Rick is organizing.
Rabbi Rick. Okay. So maybe we'll have some good chanters and singers. We're going to Mass trip.
Yes.
It's 1 hour. So we leave at 3, we'll be there at 4, probably do it for an hour, 5, and we'll end this. I'm back here, but probably by 6.
No, we normally get back at 7.
7?
Yeah.
Okay. That's it. All right, so we'll take a break for until 12 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're on the third verse. Feeling out, going over all the details. Shukadeva Goswami is praising, hearing, and chanting about Krishna. That is it. Or at least this question is glorious, and it pertains to everyone. And to hear this question is beneficial for all kinds of people. So, who has experience of hearing and chanting is beneficial? What way?
It makes my mind clearer when I chant. I've noticed it more in the last month or so.
Okay. Anyone else?
Give shelter.
What's that?
It gives shelter.
Shelter. In what way?
From material energy.
Yes. Yes.
When I'm in a bad mood, and then I read, I take the book and I read, or I go to the deities, then immediately I feel better.
Yes. Anything else? Hearing about Krishna. What about intelligence? How does it do anything to our intelligence? In other words, there are different ways can affect us. Physically, we can sit down and try and read. It may not be different from reading a book, any other book. And mentally, it may get some difference. It makes us feel better. It takes away our anxieties. Because what are basically our anxieties? We're worried what's going to happen in the future. What's that?
Worry about the past.
That's in the future. So tell us, don't worry. One time I was shooting books in the parking lot, and no one would take a book. And therefore I decided I'd sit down and read one of Prabhupada's books, calm my mind down. So I read the same purport around 5 times at least. And I noticed I couldn't read the purport because my mind was too agitated. And then after reading it out loud, slowly, and around the 5th or 6th time I could hear what the purport said, And the Prabhupada simply said that everyone was Krishna's servant. And I realized that if everyone's Krishna's servant, then there's nothing to worry about. And I went out and said, hey, take this book, it's great. And people started taking the book. Because it wasn't that I had to get such a, this realization that everyone's Krishna's servant meant that my mind wasn't disturbed anymore. Just hearing, or just the process of trying to hear it, meant that I had a control of my mind, and trying to control my mind, undoubtedly my mind wasn't controlled because I hadn't realized that Krishna, everyone was Krishna's servant. Therefore, somehow or another, my mind had become agitated, or was agitated. But just by the process of trying to hear the books, that whatever had agitated in the past, due to some relationship with someone who I thought, or someone's I thought were in Krishna's servant, now I've gotten over that, and I realize that to some extent that people were Krishna's servant. And so I could approach them as if they were Krishna's servant, and they, as Krishna's servants, they were more than happy to take the books. As whoever I thought they were, due to my agitated mind, they weren't very enthusiastic to take the book, but when my conception of them had changed, then they were more than happy to take the book. So hearing chanting can also change our conception, see things better. Now we have so many ideas, we look out through these two little eyes, and we have so many ideas of what's going on, but anyone who's been a devotee for some time, we realize that we're more or less all seeing things wrong. So the philosophy helps us see things better, simpler, actually, more clear, that we don't forget Krishna and other, under any circumstances. So this is very good because time of death is not so easy. For instance, even if I took my swimming, how do you pronounce it, goggles?
Goggles.
Goggles. To the swimming pool, I had a good pair of swimming goggles. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I put them on the shower and turned my back, someone stole them. And I was quite disturbed about it. And what to speak of, instead of stealing goggles, they decided to take my body, I would probably have been more disturbed. In other words, if we can't be undisturbed when we lose something relatively less significant, how much more disturbing it is factually when we have to give up everything we think we have now. So to see that, we have to learn how to see things so that we become unattached to thinking ourselves to be the proprietors of anything in this universe, that even our body, and that nothing belongs to us, and everything is Krishna's. So, and that the only thing I can really get here is becoming conscious of Krishna. So this is the hearing about Krishna, specifically everyone will be benefiting. And it's good for us, even at the time of death, it's good for us now, because we're suffering due to attachment, and usually we suffer more at the time of death due to even a greater attachment. All our attachments are revealed to us at the time of death. So it's good for everyone. Now in the future. So, and now in the second text, we go around and read the text. We won't necessarily read all the Sanskrit verses, although it's nice. We all learned how to chant Sanskrit from our Radhika Raman's class.
Because I need it.
Whenever you see a double vowel, you have to emphasize the double consonant, you have to emphasize the vowel before. Okay, so someone can read the second text in Sanskrit, since you're someone who knows the Sanskrit. Kopeshwar, you have a book there.
Oh, okay. Rajendra. Ninam Shanti Saharasha Apashyatam Atma Tatam Griheshu Grihamednam
translation?
Those persons who are materially engrossed, being blind to the knowledge of ultimate truth, have many things as subject matter for hearing in human society alone here.
So you can read the last paragraph.
The process of flying back home, back to Godhead, is to hear about the Supreme Lord, His name, form, attributes, past tense, paraphernalia, and variegatedness. Foolish persons do not know this. They want to hear something about the name, form, etc., of everything temporary, but they do not know how to utilize this capacity for hearing for the ultimate good. Misguided as they are, they also create some false literatures about the name, form, attributes, etc., of the ultimate truth. One should not, therefore, become a great hermit simply to exist for envy in others, but one should become a real householder in terms of the scriptural injunction.
So here Prabhupada mentions things that are rather unpalatable for most people. For instance, living only to envy others. So do you think that's true? People are just living to envy others?
Yes. We want our neighbor's car, our neighbor's wife, our neighbor's house, our neighbor's bank account. That's all good, isn't it?
Well, after you live in a temple for a few years and you start thinking, oh, actually the people are actually not so bad. Sometimes some sentiment arises like that, that here in the temple the devotees are not so nice to me, but when I go out and go to Shushu, see people seem so polite, and etc., etc. Yeah. You don't have that experience, but sometimes it happens like that. At least there's a class of devotees who sometimes they say that we're overly critical of the people in general. And that those devotees are usually much more critical of the devotees than they are of the people in general. Or, on the other hand, sometimes we hear the sannyasis or the speakers, they seem to be quite negative, always criticizing the materialistic people as if we're better than thou. So there's different varieties of these. Or even Śrīla Bhaktisiddhānta Sarasvati Prabhupāda, sometimes his followers used to criticize him because they used to say he was using the hammer technique, hammering the philosophy. So sometimes we get that also. Why are we so negative? But is this reasonable to be so, to actually label that everyone is just envious? Does anyone else have any opinions? Do you actually think everyone in your world is envious?
Yes. To some extent.
Yes.
And also in a sense, everybody is envious of Krishna. But I think also we should be careful how in preaching we do properly. We used to call scientists kind of different names. And if we cannot back up the words or with our behavior, then it can be kind of dangerous if we just kind of say. We have to be careful how to apply this. I feel like, I don't know. You can go to public program and you say, oh, everybody's jealous here, or like envious. And,
or rascals or something like that.
Hogs, dogs, camels,
yes, ass. I think it's practical application of it.
Yes, of course. Preaching is one thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Prabodhananda Saraswati Prabhupada gave us the suggestion that we approach people with a straw between our teeth. Because in India, when you approach someone with a straw between your teeth, that's a method of showing your humility. And then you fall at their feet and you flatter them 1,000 times. Oh, Thakur, oh, great personality. And after flattering them, then people's hearts usually melt a little bit. They say, yes, you're right. Mm-hmm. Finally, I met someone who can see the truth. Mm-hmm. And what can I do for you? Because after all, everyone knows that someone's flattering me. I have to, now that they know I'm God, I have to show that I'm God by benedicting them somewhat. Because that's one of the attributes of God, He gives benedictions. So how can I benedict you? Then the devotee says, well, give up all your nonsense philosophy and just take to the shelter of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Lord of His lotus feet. So that's our methodology. We show how much we appreciate people when they see that we're
friendly, appreciative of themselves and the environment may ask us to become more inquisitive, and then we can tell them something. I noticed that with my mother. I never taught philosophy with my mother. The only thing, the only mutual interest we have is that she's into health. She likes health. Anything about health she's into. Yoga, Tai Chi, everything about that. She reads our newsletters I put out. But nothing about philosophy. But then, just being friendly with her for so many years, the last time I was home, she said, "What is your philosophy anyhow?" And she called herself, "Wait, I actually don't know. I don't really want to hear." She slipped for a moment. So that's after my, I've been 35 years, it's taking a little time. It's the first time she ever asked anything about Christian consciousness. But she was, her mind saved her finally 2 months. So sometimes we have to just be friendly. But still, we have to understand. Here it says that they exist for envying others. We have to understand what this actually means. What does it mean they exist for envying others? What is the definition of agreeing to maybe? What are they really interested in? What are people really interested in?
Yes. It's kind of pleasure, then if somebody has more, then why he or not me or something? And then because of that creates kind of this end relationship between each person. And they feel that they somehow or other, this other person will kind of endanger my sense pleasure, so because of that,
yeah.
Also.
Yes, on the other hand, also, that if I had something that someone else doesn't have, then I'm afraid they're going to take it from me. They're from envious of everyone because they're my potential enemy.
Yeah.
And if they have something I don't have that I want from them, therefore I become envious of them. So the material world is a place of fear. Either I have something and I'm afraid that the people are going to take it away from me, or I don't have something and I'm afraid I'm not going to get it. So everyone is in this perpetual state of fear in the material world. And the Grihamedes, they so much old age, disease, and death, they can't solve that problem. So that's another source of envy. They can't solve their own problems. And if anyone else is better at solving the problems than they are, they become envious. There's so many reasons to be envious in the material world. And what is that envy? That next thing we'll explain. What is the field of activity for materialists? Someone want to read the next verse?
Translation?
Yeah, the Sanskrit and the translation. Because these verses are famous. Scary one's name again. What's your name again?
Yasmika.
Yasmika.
Indraya pidaye naptam yavayana chavagraha vibhat chatke daya rajam kutumpa paranena. The lifetime of such an envious householder is passed at night, either in sleeping or in sex indulgence, and in the daytime, either in making money or maintaining family members.
So everyone must be happy. So how do the karmis, they have, or the materialists, they have some way of becoming happy too. And what's the ultimate happiness? What is the only way they can even begin to think themselves to be happy?
Money.
What's that?
Money and good job, a good house, and a good wife and kids.
Yes. What is?
They think that this is the ultimate happiness.
But in the back of their minds, what are they afraid of?
Yes.
Therefore, what do they have to think or believe? What's that?
They don't want to live forever.
Yes. And how are they going to be sure that they're going to live forever? What will protect them?
Yeah, in other words, you need some assurance. You need some reason to believe that you're going to live forever, ever happily ever after. So what's the protection? What's that? Yeah, you're in a strong nation. They have atomic bombs. They have so many jets flying overhead once in a while to remind you. They're there to serve you. You have your bank balance. You have your strong children. You go to the gym every week. Whatever. Some of your body's strong.
You have good plastic surgeons.
Yes. Whatever. Somehow or another, to think like that. Because otherwise, Aranyakashipu, his first business was to become immortal. Because he knew that, how am I going to believe that I'm God, I'm the controller, I'm the enjoyer, unless I'm going to be able to stop death? If I can't do that, stop old age, disease, and death, then where is there any question of being the controller? So he made an attempt, and he failed. And he was always in anxiety, especially when Prahlad was there, that somehow or another, I can't control this little boy. Maybe I haven't gotten it all perfect yet. I haven't figured it all out. So certainly the materialist is always in anxiety, but he has some faith, even in the midst of his illusion, that he's made the best arrangement possible to protect himself. So what is that protection? That's in the next verse. Let's see. What's the Mataji's name next to Bhakti Aripa?
Kaya.
It's going to take me a long time to remember these names. I'm sorry. Kaya.
Kaya.
Kaya. What nationality is that?
Estonian.
Estonian. Koi is like, that's a name for a sweet in Bengali sweet.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Oh. Now I know the meaning.
It's a bird as well. It's
yeah,
French. And then we saw the ties that we put down in the kitchen at Sky.
Is it Sanskrit? Deha patya kala pradish tatma sanye asasvapi tisam pramata nidhanam pasyana pina parsati. Persons devoid of atma-tattva do not inquire into the problems of life, being too attached to the follies of soldiers like the body, children and wife. Although sufficiently experienced, they still do not see their inevitable destruction.
So you can read this starting with this. Material world exists only as a dream. You'll find it
in the bottom of the page.
This material world exists only as a dream due to our attachment to it. Otherwise, the living soul is always different from the material nature. The great ocean of material nature is tossing with the waves of time, and the so-called living conditions are something like foaming bubbles which appear before us as bodily self, wife, children, society, countrymen, etc. Due to a lack of knowledge of self, we become victimized by the force of ignorance and thus spoil the valuable energy of human life in a vain search after permanent living conditions which are impossible in this material world.
So here the Sri Prabhupada is writing that the material nature is comparing it to tossing waves in the sea, and the existences that we see before us are just like foaming bubbles. So if we went to our parents and said that you're just another foaming bubble that's appearing before me that's about to burst, so how can I take you seriously? Would that be very good preaching?
No.
Wouldn't that be telling the truth? Why would it be a very good preaching? As we find in the beginning, sometimes the brahmacharis would go home And the mother would come, Brahmacharya would go, "Don't touch me. Get away from me. You're an illusion." Could that warm the hearts of the mothers up? So, oh, my son has finally realized I'm an illusion. So what to the extent is an illusion, and what to the extent is it real? The relationships we have.
To the extent that Krishna is, we put Krishna in the center.
Well, that, yes, that's true. But why is it that the mother doesn't think that she's not going to put Krishna in the center?
She doesn't have that.
Yes. So to the extent that the devotee puts Krishna in the center, then the relationship is real. So even if some of our associates don't always, especially our relatives, put Krishna in the center, so if we put Krishna in the center, then it becomes real, the relationship. But due to lack of knowledge, we become victimized by the force of ignorance and that spoil the valuable energy of human life in a vain search after permanent living conditions which are impossible in this material world. So what is everyone getting together? And then all their, what is all the show of material progress, society, friendship, and love? What is ultimately everyone's aiming at? Oh, it says here, permanent living conditions. Is that true, that everyone is, this whole endeavor is to try and find something permanent?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They did a survey in America asking people what their first priority was, giving a whole list, whether they wanted an increase of money or they liked their job. And most people wanted simply job security.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because
after all, if you don't have a job, it doesn't matter whether you like it or not, you have nothing, you don't have anything. So they're afraid of not having a job. Why do people eat every day? When you go on an airplane, sometimes I guess most of us have traveled by airplane, and when you don't take the food offered by the hostess, they get very anxious. They think that maybe you'll die from starvation on the plane. They'll have to take care of the body. They start wondering why they're rejecting the food. Maybe there's something wrong with it, and we're eating it. No, we're all afraid of dying. The very thing that's sure, we're all working. In the material world, people are working for avoiding. They go to their checkups, they go to their medical checkups, they run around the block, they try and get the best food they can, etc. Because people want to live as long as possible. And of course, they want to enjoy, but if you're not alive, you can't enjoy. Unless you're a ghost.
Okay.
What's that?
But ghosts, you cannot get so much sense pleasure.
No, they don't know that. They think everyone's going to become Casper the Friendly Ghost. Become a nice ghost. Because people are in ignorance, they have no idea. And it's hard to figure out what the conceptions are. As I mentioned, that in America, they have a cemetery where you pay and they pipe into your coffin different kinds of music. Before you leave your body, you have to tell them what kind of music you want to listen to. And then they pipe it into your coffin. Because they have some conception that I'm somehow or another going to be there. And that if I like a certain type of music, like rock music, or country western music, or classical music, then I can listen. I have plenty of time to listen to it. So busy when I was alive, but when I'm dead, I'll have plenty of time. So that therefore they want to listen to a certain type of music when they're dead.
But then, as well in your country, there's a system of freezing the body for a future period.
Well, then they think that after they defrost you, they'll have a cure for what was ever wrong with you.
Mm.
Yeah, people want to live because we're eternal. At least if we're alive, there's some hope. But if we're dead, if we cease to exist, then there's no hope. Therefore, somehow or another, they want to believe that they're going to live forever. The fact is that everyone will live forever, but because they don't know about the soul,
Therefore, they conceive of living forever within a body. Even there's a religion where they believe that after we leave this body, we get the same body in the spiritual world, or in the heavenly world, whatever. It's a very prominent religion that believes like that. And the Mormons.
Christianity in general.
What is that?
Christianity in general.
Christianity. Any, especially the religions that take you after the philosophy of Zoroastrianism. For Zoroastrianism taught that there's a heaven and there's a hell, and there's a very narrow path, and people fall off the path to go to hell. The heaven and hell philosophy taught by the Christians, the Jewish, the Muslims, all coming from the Zoroastrianism, this heaven and hell concept. But they believe that you go to heaven and there you get yourself same body. And there you're in a young body, of course. Your parents are in an older body, your grandparents are in a really old body, but they're there eternally. If you try to figure it out, it doesn't make any sense, but after all, religion's not supposed to make sense, they think. Some people want to live forever, but here it says we're only a dead body flapping for some time. And then we have to leave the body, we'll get another dead body which flaps for some time. And what is the solution? Text number 5. Erica?
Tasmat Bharata Sarvatma Bhagavan Ishvaro Hari Shrutavya Kirti Tavyascha Smartavyas Chichata Ayam. A descendant of King Bharata, one who desires to be free from all miseries, must hear about, glorify, and also remember the personality of Godhead, who is the Super Soul, the controller and the savior from all misery.
So, and here it says, therefore, in the purport.
Therefore, one should first of all hear.
Therefore,
if
one desires freedom from this fish, this is a. 10 lines down. After the 8, no, there's 3 lines after.
Therefore, if one desires freedom from this vicious circle, then one must cease to act as a karmi or enjoyer of the result of one's own work, good or bad. One should not do anything, either good or bad, on his own account, but must execute everything on behalf of the Supreme Lord, the ultimate proprietor of everything that be.
That's good. The most important principle here is that we should understand that there's a Supreme Lord. How many people really accept the fact that there's a Supreme Lord? In other words, if you ask someone, I don't know about in Europe, but in America at least, if you ask them if they believe in God, practically everyone in America believes in God. If you ask them anything about God, they don't know anything about God. So the question is, how is they come to a position where something that they know nothing about, they believe in? How does that happen? Or how is that possible? Does anyone have any idea? I mean, it's happening, so how is it going on?
And in America, in the New World, you know, the New World started with the French and the English trying to colonize that side of the world, so they took religion, of course, with the missionaries. And we speak about God every day. Everybody knows that there's a God. We see him through the trees and the plants and the birds, and it stays there.
It says on the dollar as well, in God we trust.
Do you think they get trust God or they trust the dollar? I think they think the dollar is almighty. But they must have some understanding of God. I mean, they read something about God in the Bible. There's something there, but they don't know very much about God. Himself personally, nothing, right, speaking, unless they read Prabhupada's book. They know nothing about a person, but they know something about how he works through his energy, something like that.
The Holy Spirit people.
Yeah, the energies. So that's also what will be dealt with here. But in the first, second canto, a full description of Krishna is not going to be given, or even Vishnu or any of his expansion. Something about him is given, though, but not a full description. But especially this emphasizes how his energies work. So there is some kind of belief in a supreme almighty who's better than us, that's observable through the energies. But here it says that, again, that service attitude, which will be explained. And what is that service attitude? That one has to cease as being an enjoyer of the results of one's work, good or bad. The basic principle is that dutiful work, vana and ashram, tells us that you have this body has a certain duty to perform. Do that duty for, that's called sacrifice. And generally speaking, the vana and ashram system aims at performing sacrifice, especially performing sacrifices to the demigods. But people don't believe in the demigods. There are, how many people in this world actually believe in the demigods, or even how many people have any idea how to satisfy the demigods? Although that's what it means, that one should be not the enjoyer of one's dutiful action. So the only hope in this age, the only dutiful action, is to perform activities to the Sankirtan Jagat, gradually speaking. Sankirtan. Because the other types of dutiful activities, they won't get any results. Even if I act dutifully as a karmi, I take care of my family, I take care of my country, but that's rapidly diminishing because the center is being lost. God, namely. We can't understand that we're part of a family unless we know who the father is. Just like if you don't know who your father is, you don't know who your mother is, then how can you understand who your brothers and sisters are? Similarly, without some kind of God consciousness as a center, we can't understand what the center is. Therefore, all attempts at being dutiful will diminish. Because I'm married to someone because they gratify my senses. And if they don't gratify my senses, then I don't marry. I'm not married anymore. And the only opposite is the duty behind it. So, unless I understand who my duty is to, then how can I work dutifully? If I try to be dutiful to the country, but the country is very whimsical. Its laws change all the time, but my duty is to the country will always change. If I'm dutiful to my religion that doesn't understand anything about God, then they change their religion too. Previously in the Catholic Church, you weren't supposed to eat meat on certain days, but now because it's not popular, they change that. Certain religions, you were supposed to be, you were a priest, you were supposed to not be married, but now they've changed it because it's not very popular. So any your duty can change all the time. The only permanent, only God doesn't change according to our whims, like what we feel. There's no amount of democracy can change God's opinion. It's not that we all vote that we don't like Krishna being God anymore, so Krishna says, oh, how unfortunate. Who would you like to be God? I'll step down for some time. The laws of God, God himself, they don't change. Therefore, unless there is some center in the instructions coming from Krishna, and for the materialist, he realizes that through an indirect process, through worshiping the universal form, recognizing the demigods as being controllers, doing what's necessary to satisfy them so they supply the necessities of life, etc., then they begin to realize that there's higher controllers and that I have a duty towards them. So that's vana and ashram. But in the absence of that, people have no idea. Their only duty, they think, Krishna says, is just to gratify their senses. And since they feel bad because they have some infusion of God consciousness coming from Christianity or Mohammedanism or Islam or Judaism, they feel bad about eating people. tip where they refrain generally, most people, from eating each other. But it's only because they feel guilty. Otherwise, if they don't feel guilty, they don't mind eating someone. They think, well, that's all right, because I don't feel guilty. They feel a little tinge of guilty because they have some humanity left in them. But that's trying to be destroyed in so many ways by just more or less accustomizing people. If the people get accustomed to violence, then it becomes normal. They become customized to all kinds of media propaganda, pornography, or other types of things. Then it's just normal. They become accustomed to it. The same way that that Yamaraj trains up people to become a pig. It's not that you just overnight you just get transformed into a pig, because we're not used to being a pig. So you have to get trained up to be a pig. So they train you up eating certain foods, and after a while you get used to them. Or the way they train a tiger. They starve the tiger until it gets hungry, and then when it gets hungry, then it becomes very docile. Can't do anything. It becomes very weak. And when the trainer comes and whips him, he feels out completely at the mercy of the trainer. He gets conditioned that without the trainer's mercy, I can't do anything. So the trainer comes, whips him, beats him up, and then finally he gives him some food, so the tiger feels completely dependent on the mercy of the trainer. If the trainer wants, he'll whip me, and if he wants, he'll give me some food, so I should be nice to the trainer. So in the same way, we're all conditioned, feeling dependent, especially in modern society, on the mercy of the society. Previously, people were farmers. They felt that they had to be dependent on the rain. Unless the rain came, they couldn't grow anything. Unless the atmosphere was proper. And they knew they were in control of the rain. They were in control of the sun. And therefore, they had some conception that if God was pleased, if the higher power was pleased, these things would come. So they were more religious. But now people are divorced from that. They have to depend upon their boss. If the boss is pleased, then they get their salary. And if they get their salary, then they can go and buy the food from the store. And if the boss is displeased, then they won't get their salary, they won't get any food. They'll starve. So they become like the animal being trained up by the lion trainer. Completely at the mercy of their boss, and the boss is at the mercy of his boss, etc., etc. And there's some people controlling everything. If they want, they can crash the economy and everyone starves. And if they want, people can mercifully work for them for nothing. Just paying off their mortgage, paying off the car, paying off their children's education, so they can learn how to become bona fide dependents on the society. They can also get a job like them and work for their car and house and for their children's education. And just a few people, more or less, if they feel good about you, you're blessed, and if they feel bad about you, you're condemned. So at least some people on the top, they feel like they're God. And everyone else on the bottom, they feel like they're dependent on these gods. But they allow conception that some way or another, they're also God. So everyone's more or less under the illusion that I'm God, but they don't know who the real gods are. And what's the result? Simply a lot of problems. They're fighting in Iraq now. They're fighting other places for oil, for the few they said in the year 2000. And they had a convention in Brazil that in the 21st century, or I guess it's the 21st century, they'll have big wars over water. When water runs out, they'll have wars fighting over the sources of water. Now they're fighting over oil or whatever. And in the future it'll be water, and then it'll be other things too.
Necessities.
Yeah, just the basic necessities. Because they're not God conscious, therefore all these things will diminish.
As we may come back on something, I agree totally with what you said about future table. But if you don't work, for example, even here, it's the Kami's money that comes in and not everything going. If you don't work, how are we going to live?
We didn't say you shouldn't work. But that feeling of dependency on your boss, that's going to be there. Of course, everyone is ultimately dependent upon Krishna, because if there wasn't some either past sacrifice or present sacrifice, there wouldn't be any rain whatsoever, or there would be too much rain, and everyone would starve. But because we're feeling dependent, if we start feeling dependent like that on the materialist, then automatically we have to accept their values also. Because if they're not pleased with our values, they won't give us the necessities of life. We'll feel we will be deprived. But we ourselves, even in the midst of this situation, we have to develop a dependency upon Krishna. That ultimately it's not these people are bringing these things because Krishna is telling them to, not because they're necessarily we have to please them. Or if we please Krishna, then automatically so many other people will also be pleased. The demigods will be pleased, and they'll tell these people to bring them, even if they don't want to. You know, in book distribution, you can see that. If you want to serve Krishna in that way, then Krishna sends the people. And sometimes someone doesn't even want to give a donation, but Krishna tells them to, and they have to. I mean, I see that a lot. People just don't want to. But Krishna tells them to, so that they don't know why they're doing it, but they just got to. And you see people say, I'm not going to give you a donation. They walk in and they say, well, all right, I'll give you a donation. After some, you just talk to them, you don't say anything. After a while, they say, oh, okay. Or like, you probably approached me for donation, right? I'm not going to give you a donation. Just talk to them for a few minutes. And they go, can you give a donation? Say, sure, why not? So to think you're dependent upon people's whimsical minds, actually we depend on Krishna. And if we pray, if we're actually dependent on Krishna, we want to do Krishna's business, then he'll arrange it. And if we depend upon anything else other than Krishna, maybe due to our past activities, Krishna will arrange it, maybe not. Here, very important verse, hear, chant, and remember Krishna. That's our duty. So hearing and chanting and remembering Krishna is not just hearing and chanting sitting in the Bhagavatam class. Prabhupada mentions that one should not be chanting is also with his body. In English they say actions speak louder than words. You've heard that before?
Yes.
So we're also, by our activities, we're also chanting. That's the result of hearing. And chanting also means to perform the activities that we're talking about. Not that we just say one thing, but we do something else. But primarily, we hear, we explain to others, and we also show by our example. Srikanthi Mahaprabhu emphasized that. As an acharya, one should not only preach, but one should show what one is preaching by one's example. In a more subtle way, we can understand that our activities are really not different from everything is coming from sound vibration. Although we differentiate between sound and other types of material energy, but actually everything originates from sound. What we see as our activities, or as our bodies, everything else is really just a product of sound also. In the sense that whatever we heard about, whatever we've understood, we've acted upon, and that created past bodies. And those past bodies, when we utilize them according to what we understood, created our present body. So this body is really is a result of what we've heard and what we've done in the past. Therefore, to show people that we want to be devotees, we've understood what we've heard, then we not only have to repeat it to others verbally, but we also have to repeat it in our own actions. The main thing is not to be an enjoyer of the results of our activities. We have 5 minutes left, so how is it that although we're preaching Krishna consciousness, that we're not supposed to be the enjoyers of the activities, what are some of the obstacles that make it difficult to remember them? Anyone find any difficulties sometimes remembering that we're not supposed to be the enjoyers of our activities, good or bad. Yes.
And my problem is always because in the Bhagavad Gita there is this, it depends on your intention, why you are doing something, and if you give donations with the wrong intention, the result will also. See, I don't know, it's also in a different mode. Maybe, I mean, to give a donation in more ignorance, it's maybe better to give more donation, or I don't know.
Well, say you're doing your service, and someone comes up to you and says, what was your name again?
Tanya.
They go, Tanya, you did a great service. Is there any problem? They tell you, you're doing great service. We really appreciate your service. Is there any problem if someone tells you that? Say you went on Book Distribution, you distributed 10 books, and they read off out your name, saying, Bhakti and Tanya just distributed 10 Maha big books, and everyone went, Jai! Is there any problem in terms of not enjoying or good or bad results of your work?
I don't understand the point.
Well, did you ever distribute any books? Have you ever distributed books?
Yeah.
Did anyone ever say that was a very nice service that you rendered?
Yes.
What did you think when they told you that? How did you feel?
Good.
That's good. So there's nothing. But what did you think? Did you think that, yes, I did bring nice service and I deserve credit?
I mean, there are two things that I know theoretically. What I hear is that Krishna does it, but of course I'm identified with what I did.
Yeah, so that's the difficulty. Is that, for instance, someone came up and said, you just cleaned the temple room, but it looks a mess. How would you feel then?
I don't know if I would do it again.
Yeah, so one sense, if we're praised, we become attached. If we're criticized, we become attached too. Say someone walked in this. So, attached to the good and bad results of our work. Now, how do we not become attached to the good results of our work? Is it possible not to be attached?
Yes and no. If you do it because you need to do it and you have to do it, you just do it.
Well, say at our state, of course, in the higher state of Krishna consciousness, we can understand that one realizes that I'm not the doer, I'm simply an instrument. So therefore, any credit one gives to Krishna, one knows that Krishna is doing it. So yes, Krishna is doing very nice. And then one thinks, oh, this person's a nice devotee, they're appreciating what Krishna's doing, they're a better devotee than I am, because they're appreciating what Krishna's doing, but I can't appreciate people's service, Krishna's, anyone else's service as nicely as their praise is emitted. So therefore, when someone praises one, one thinks on it, one becomes a devotee of that person, thinking how nicely they're praising Krishna, or Krishna's devotees. On the other hand, if someone criticizes me, I think, of course, I'm not very realized, I'm not very advanced in Krishna consciousness, I can't do anything to please Krishna, but so, they're criticizing me, so I should become more devotional. Or at least more tolerant. There's so many different ways of looking at it. But ultimately, we should have some philosophy so that we're not either attached when there is good or distressed when there is bad. And how to do that? One has to fix the mind upon Krishna. According to the Bhagavad Gita, that naprari shat priyam prapya, no du yet prapya priyam, stira buddhira samudo, brahmanid brahmanisitaha. A person who's not joyful when he obtains something pleasant, nor the man communicating something unpleasant, who is self-intelligent, unbewildered, and who knows the science of God, is said to be situated in transcendence. Vyas Parashaya Vasavgatma Vindakatmani Yatsukam Sabrahma Yoga Yukatma Sukham Akshayam Ashvite. Such a person is always in trance, not attracted to material sense objects or external pleasure, but is always in trance, enjoying the pleasure from within. In this way, the self-realized soul enjoys unlimited pleasure because he concentrates on the Supreme. In other words, our solution is always to think about Krishna. If we're doing, let's say you were cleaning the floor and you were in ecstasy thinking about Krishna the whole time, and then someone came along and said, well, you didn't seem to be doing a good job. So what would be the reaction? If I was acting in ecstasy, I think, well, they're probably right. I could have done a better job. But one will not be very disturbed because one will think, well, it may have been a bad job, but it was really nice doing it. On the other hand, if one was in anxiety and suffering, and someone comes along and says, oh, you're doing a great job, you would appreciate the fact that the person is trying to encourage you. We may even try to relish the praise, but you remember the job I was actually, it was quite painful and distressful doing it. You wouldn't get too much attached. Said someone asked you, would you like to do it again? Well, I'm not so sure. Praise was nice, but the job wasn't so nice. But if we see things, if we're factually in Krishna consciousness, then we won't be disturbed, either in good or bad. If we're actually happy doing the work, doing the service. And if we're not happy doing the service, we may try and relish some kind of happiness from, you know, profit, adoration, distinction, or some other way, the profit from the work, the results from it. We won't be very much attracted to the work again. Except the fact it gives some result. But at least we know that in the material world, even if you get a result sometimes, you're not always going to get the result. But after if you don't like the work, then the result starts coming, then you'll give it up, obviously, the work. And since our work is Krishna consciousness, that we should be happy doing the work, and we should be attached to the results of the work, because if we're attached to the results of the work, then the work will never be satisfied, because we'll think about the results rather than Krishna. The only way we can actually be happy doing our work is by doing it for Krishna, then we'll think about Krishna and we won't be attached to the result. But as soon as we become attached to the result, then we'll think about that when we're doing the work. We think the result is more relishable than thinking about Krishna, then we'll think about the result rather than Krishna. Gross or subtle, material world people work for money. And in Krishna consciousness, the tendency is we start working for subtler things because we're not getting any money. Spiritual. We're supposed to be spiritual workers. And therefore, sometimes we start working spiritually when we're attached to profit, adoration, distinction. And if we don't get that, then we get discouraged. Thank you. So we'll go and hurry down today. Someone's going to arrange that. They know where we're going to go. Where do we meet? It's going to tell everyone. Are they going to make an announcement?
It's probably only this 3 o'clock from the past. I just have to confirm it about today.
Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.